You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Senator Bernie Sanders won a narrow victory in the New Hampshire primary last night. We'll talk about what it means for the rest of the nominating process during our look at the week in national politics. Now, Wisconsin absentee voters are going to see two ballots arriving for the spring elections. The State Elections Commission estimates this could affect about 81,000 voters. One ballot, ballot A, comes first, just has some of the voting on it, while ballot B comes second, it's going to have even more of it, more of the state and local races. A similar situation has already happened this year with double ballots being sent out because of the 7th District congressional election. It's not a mistake. PBS Wisconsin's Here and Now host Frederica Freiberg recently talked to City of Superior Clerk Terry Kalan about how election officials will treat the two ballots.
If they return both of them, we will reject ballot A and we will count ballot B.
Laura Schulte has been covering the issue for the Wausau Daily Herald, where she's public issues and watchdog reporter. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
All right, this is kind of complicated. It's a little hard for me to follow anyway. Let's take it one step at a time. And I want to start with the 7th District there, people getting two ballots, absentee ballots for voting in the primaries. What led to that happening?
Yeah, so basically the confusion there comes from difference in state and federal rules. So federal ballots have to go out 47 days at least before the election, and state ballots have to go out 21 days. So by the time candidates had declared in our local races, the ballots for the 7th District congressional primary had to go out already. So that ballot A that went out, for example, in Marathon County where I've been covering, that ballot A just had the 7th Congressional District Democratic and Republican candidates. And then it was shortly followed by ballot B, which has all of the local races, which is the primaries for city council, county board, that kind of stuff, as well as the 7th congressional primary candidates.
So it's entirely plausible that somebody listening in that large portion of the state might be at home with one ballot in each hand thinking, do what now? So what are they supposed to do with the two separate ballots?
So if you have both ballots, all you are required to send back if you want to send it back is ballot B. If you fill that out, it'll be counted. It'll be great. If you ended up sending both ballots back, the counters will only look at that B ballot. If you only send back the A ballot, then they'll only look at that and your vote will go towards the 7th District.
But then you're opting out of the other elections that might have been on the B ballot.
Yes, you're basically opting out of the elections locally.
And people might think, all right, I've got two ballots in my hand with at least a couple of the same races on them. I don't want to cheat and send two ballots in and risk double voting and, you know, maybe getting caught doing that. They should not be worried about that. Do I have that right, Laura?
They should not be worried about that. I had talked with the Marathon County Clerk about this, and she said that if voters do end up sending back both ballots, like, oops, I already filled it out and sent it back before I got the B ballot, only one of the ballots will be counted. So in the case both get sent back, it'll only be the B ballot. And that will be done on election day. She told me that poll workers will actually be going through and looking at those ballots.
That sounds complicated from a vote counting standpoint, but it sounds like the clerk you talked to, and we heard about the one in Superior too, they seem to have this well in hand.
Yeah, they say that it's not going to be an issue. And the Elections Commission said the same thing.
Talking to Laura Schulte from the Wausau Daily Herald, talking about why some voters have already gotten two ballots for the spring primary elections if they're voting absentee. That's in Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. And why voters around the state will see that now in the final round of primary elections here or in the primary elections for president and state elections, including for Supreme Court. All right, Laura, that takes us to those later elections. Now the rest of the state will see what the 7th District saw.
Yes. So then we're going to see it again with the presidential primary here. So the A ballots should be getting ready to go out soon if they haven't already. And that'll only include the candidates for the presidential primary. And that'll be followed by a B ballot, which will include your local races for April 7th, as well as the presidential primary. And it's the same exact situation. If you get both ballots, you only have to fill out and return the B ballot to your clerk.
Right, because it would be impossible to turn it around in time with the primary results from next week, have it on the same ballot as the presidential, and get it out in time to meet the standards that time period for the presidential one. I said that confusingly. Do I have it basically right?
Exactly. So our primaries next week are February 18th. These ballots have to go out on February 20th. That would give only 2 days to do all that work to get everything prepared to go out. So that's that led to the situation, again, with the A and B ballots.
And this, do the same kind of rules apply for if you cast an A and then a B ballot, you're still okay and only the B is going to be counted?
Exactly. That A ballot will be discarded.
How about you used the word discarded. Do we know how the paper trail is going to work here? So say I vote absentee. I have an A and a B. Are they going to keep both of them for, you know, for posterity and for a paper trail if recounts have to happen?
That is a very good question that I actually do not have the answer.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it anywhere either. So I think that maybe we'll try to track that down here. Are people feeling confused by this? Do you know? I am.
I spoke with the Marathon County clerk today, and I asked her, have you been getting a lot of questions? And she said that when they mailed out their ballots, that they actually included an insert that they tried to explain in depth what was happening and why they received two ballots. And she said that they actually hadn't received a single question in Marathon County. So hoping it was pretty clear to people between news coverage and those inserts in the ballot that kind of cleared things up for them.
It doesn't seem like this happens very often, kind of like, you know, an eclipse. Just the right things have to line up, the presidential elections and then nonpartisan elections and others. Oh, and a special election, I guess, in the state. This isn't something we have to worry about most years, is it?
It hasn't been, but actually races didn't quite line up in 2012 and 2016. But there weren't two ballots in those years. So technically the clerks had violated the law with that. And had not sent out two different ballots because there was a miscommunication. They weren't aware of the rules, but the differing time.
And just to hammer home one more point before we let you go, Laura, if you're an absentee voter, you have two ballots, you're not going to get in trouble if you fill them both out and send them back in. Am I clear on that?
You are not going to get in trouble. They'll only look at the B ballot if you fill out both.
Fantastic. I understand it way better now. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Laura Salty, public issues and watchdog reporter at the Wausau Daily Herald. We talked to her today about absentee voters in Wisconsin getting two ballots, the A ballot and the B ballot for the spring election. Coming up, we'll meet a Wisconsin woman with a lifelong passion for birds and talk about her work rescuing injured eagles and other raptors. Find out more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest released rehabilitated bald eagles in Prairie du Sac last weekend, something she's been doing for pretty much her entire adult life. We'll talk with her about her appreciation for raptors and her hopes for protecting birds. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about Rib Mountain.
Author Jill Sisson Quinn likes spending time at Rib Mountain State Park outside Wausau. She recently took a hike there with her young son for a lesson about our place in the universe.
I want my 4-year-old son to climb a mountain. Not so easy in Wisconsin. Long ago, mountains as high as the Rockies covered the area, which is now our state. But today, I'll have to settle for 1,942-foot Rib Mountain. It's a remnant of that ancient Rocky-sized range buried by sediment, then revealed through erosion. I'm not concerned by the modest elevation, because this mountain sports something more impressive, its age. Rib Mountain contains some of the oldest rock in the world. At 1.7 billion years old, these rocks have been around for more than a third of the Earth's existence. We rub our hands across the striations on the side of a boulder, made by waves when the now quartzite was a river valley or ocean bottom. Long ago, this rock used to be sand, I say. I am awed by this evidence of the rock's previous forms. First sand, then sandstone, now quartzite. I tell my son to think about the ripples the ocean makes along the seashore. He gets it, looking around the heavily wooded mountaintop and responding, "There must not have been any trees here then." Next, I tell him the rock's age, knowing full well his understanding of such things still has a long way to go, his own number of fingers and toes as yet a daily discovery. This window of not yet complete awareness of his own form might be a good time, I figure, to convince him of what we, like the rock, really are. The rock is old, I say to my son, but you and the rock are really the same age, around 13.8 billion years old. The atoms in your body and the atoms in the rock made just after the birth of the universe and in exploding stars. You are stardust. Stardust, he repeats and smiles. He's heard me say it before. I want my son to take the long view, to think like a mountain even when he is not on the mountain, and not only about the earth, as Aldo Leopold imparted, but about himself. We should not get mired in how one strand of identity formulates us, but consider all the strands, the food we eat, the microbes we host, where we grow up, and the DNA we inherit, no more or less important than the atoms that make up all this stuff. I don't deny what we appreciate in the rock, its consistency of form, being itself, over such an unimaginable period of time. It's old, it's something, it has exactly the sort of permanence we ourselves desire. I come to the mountain today not only in a parent's feeble attempt to make my son seem immortal, but to help him better navigate life's journey, its hard facts, as well as its uncertainties. 100 years, the most humans can expect, is not much. Yet over that 100 years, our solid-seeming body is in constant change. Individual cells live from a few days to at most 10 years, continuously rebuilt from materials from our immediate environment. We are not sandstone, then quartzite for 1 billion years, or even human for 100. We are sea, land, and sky, all in one lifetime.
Jill Sisson-Quinn is an author who teaches writing at Mid-State Technical College and lives in Scandinavia, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Now, you may have heard our next guest featured on Ideas Network shows and WPR news stories over the years. Marge Gibson is the president and co-founder of Anago-based Raptor Education Group, Inc., or Reggie. They nurse sick and injured birds back to health with the goal of releasing them back into the wild. This past weekend, Marge released 3 rehabilitated bald eagles in Prairie du Sac. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, she's done this more than 1,000 times through her career. We thought it'd be fun to get to know her a little better and learn more about her work at Reggie. Marge, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
How'd the release go this weekend in Prairie du Sac?
It was absolutely beautiful. It couldn't have gone better. We had about 2,500 people there, and everyone got to see and appreciate the eagles. So it was really a beautiful time.
I will say I wasn't there this weekend, but I have been at the eagle release in the past. And what I didn't expect was kind of just the emotional surge of seeing these rehabilitated eagles take flight over the river. Does it still have that power for you even after you've done it so many times?
You know, it never gets old. And I think that, you know, when people think you're used to it, you know, I've worked with eagles for 50 years, and everyone still holds me in awe. And, well, every bird does. And I think that, you know, no, it never gets old. I think when it does, I need to quit.
What led you to devote so much of your life to raptors and other birds?
You know, I'm one of those incredibly lucky people that it was my life's passion, even before I knew what a passion was. My parents maintained that my very first word was birdie. And, you know, they were, you know, pretty surprised, but they were very nature-oriented. I was the youngest, so they chose to sort of accept this strange little child that they produced and let me go with it.
Now, you ended up here in Wisconsin, and there's been just this incredible story with bald eagles in particular, this decline and the rise. When you first got here, where were we with bald eagles in Wisconsin?
Well, I was actually born in Antigo, after college, moved to California. So I was there for about 28 years and moved back as my parents got a little older, and I really wanted to come back to my roots and try to give back to my state that had nurtured me. So the eagles were at a better population than when I left. When I was a kid, we really didn't have many at all. In fact, if you saw an eagle, it was a kind of a rare exception. So it was gratifying to come back and see them and to see the population improving. And one of the things that we did was I had worked with condors and golden eagles and bald eagles in California and then up in Alaska with the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So I had more recently worked with eagles, so it was kind of fresh on my mind. And the very first birds we accepted into rehab here were bald eagles. So we really ended up having to build a facility that would suit them and would allow them to recover in condition and that sort of thing, and that's kind of how Reggie was born.
Talking to Marge Gibson, president and co-founder of the Antigo-based Raptor Education Group, Inc., or Reggie. Marge, that's a very unique design. How does one design and create a rehabilitation facility that can meet the needs of eagles and other birds?
Well, what they need is a lot of space. They need to fly, and they need to be able to turn. And if an eagle or any bird, for instance, has a broken wing or a broken leg or starvation, they lose their muscles. They atrophy their muscles, so they have to build that back up before they're able to go back out into the wild. And fly, they're very much like an airplane. If they're missing some wing feathers, it's like an airplane missing part of its wing or its tail, so it really affects their flight. And we have to make sure they're perfect. So basically, it's a really large building, and it's about 110 feet long, 60 feet wide, and it is sectioned off smaller areas on one side. But they're able to fly in there. They're able to socialize with other eagles of all ages. We have an area where our foster parent eagles can raise orphans, so they're not imprinted to humans. And that's a very, very important thing when they're going back out into the wild.
A lot of the eagles you deal with and other birds are there because of injuries. What are some of the most preventable causes of an eagle ending up at Reggie that you would hope we could just stop in the first place?
Well, about 90% of the injuries or the problems that we see are man-made. So part of rehab, with at least my emphasis, is if it's man-caused, then it's responsibility of us to try to fix that. So that's kind of the premise by which I work. There's poisonings, a lot of poisonings. Lead poisoning is one of the big ones, and that comes after deer season, basically, if hunters are still using lead ammunition. Lead doesn't, the bullet doesn't go through the animal that's the target animal. It fragments, and it looks like a storm inside, and people don't realize that. But when the gut piles are left, and maybe sometimes even people even shoot a deer and the deprivation permit, hoping to feed the eagles because they like them, but they don't realize that they're actually poisoning them, and that's something that people can change. Just use copper bullets, not copper plated, but copper bullets, and it would take care of the whole thing. Other kinds of poisoning, rat poisoning. It not only poisons the target animals, but it poisons if something eats that rat or that rabbit or that squirrel that has had contact with rodent poisoning, they too are poisoned. So like a domino effect. And again, that's something that we just have to be very aware of and realize that, it's not only the target animal. Hit by cars, just be more careful. If you see a deer in the road, if you can drag it off to the side, that would be wonderful. People think that eagles are you know, they can get out of anywhere because they're eagle, right? But they're large when they have a full crop. They're lumbering, and they really need space to get airborne, and they don't have that quickly when a car is coming around the corner. So they really can't get out of the way and are often hit and injured.
I understand this year marks Reggie's 30th anniversary. What are you most proud of over those three decades?
You know, I think the education that we do, education, of course, it's part of our name. And one of the things that I think is the most important, educating the public about the birds that we share our life with. That's one of the reasons that the public releases are important. People get to see them and appreciate them and really understand them on a different level. I can tell people about them, but until they experience them, they truly don't. They don't get it, or they think they do. But seeing one very close, and I walk around the crowd in a safe manner, of course. But what I love most is the little children can see them and start to think about maybe their future, what they can do. Maybe they can be part of the solution for wildlife when they grow up. And I think that might be the most important thing that we do.
Now, my wife commented one time growing up in Wisconsin, never seeing sandhill cranes or hardly ever. And now our kids, you know, we see them all the time. Do you think as you're working of that next generation of kids, maybe saying birdie for the first time, that you know, you might have helped put those birds in the sky for them to see?
Well, I sure hope so. I guess that's something that I wanted to do. But I think just stimulating people, you know, just stimulating people to do good things on their own is what I hope I've done. And bringing reality back to, you know, to the public and to kids, that kids are naturally interested in wildlife, they're naturally interested in outdoors, and just letting them do that and telling them it's okay and that, you know, the eagle's not going to eat them, you know, and telling them about the intelligence so they can make up their own mind. And that's an important thing.
Marge, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
Marge Gibson is the executive director of the Anago-based Raptor Education Group, Inc., or Reggie. We talked to her about her passion for raptors, especially eagles, and her group's mission to rehabilitate and release those birds into the wild. You can get more info on Reggie and what they do at raptoreducationgroup.org. Coming up, Democrats held their second contest of the primary season last night. We'll talk about how the race is taking shape and how different states, when they get into the game, could still shake things up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:15 on the morning show, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin joins the program for a look at President Trump's budget proposal and efforts to lower the costs of prescription medications. That's tomorrow morning at 7:15 here on the Ideas Network. Now we take a look at the week in national politics. The Justice Department is seeking a shorter prison sentence than its own prosecutors had recommended for former Trump campaign consultant Roger Stone, raising concerns from some in Congress about political interference in the justice system. And in election news, Democratic candidates held their second primary contest last night in New Hampshire. Senator Bernie Sanders came out on top, former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg came in second, and Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar in third. You can join in with your thoughts on the primary campaign at 800-642-1234. If you're planning to vote Democratic, what are you looking at to decide which candidate you'll vote for? Who are you leaning toward? Would you vote for the nominee, the Democratic nominee, no matter who it might be? If you're a supporter of President Trump, what do you think he should emphasize in his campaign? If you're somewhere in the middle, what's going to determine who gets your vote? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill, focusing on House leadership. Scott, good to have you back.
Good to be back, Rob.
Before we dig into the first couple results, Iowa and New Hampshire, some context. The two states so far have awarded 64 delegates out of more than 4,000 overall, so still a long way to go, right?
Yeah, there's still a lot of runway in this, but I think we have a little bit of clarity after these two contests. We know that The left is rallying behind Bernie Sanders. I think there had been some question as to who would be the progressive candidate to emerge out of this field. Would it be Bernie or Elizabeth Warren? Seems to be Bernie has the momentum despite that setback with a heart attack last year. And then, of course, a couple surprises. Pete Buttigieg, a relatively unknown politician a year or two ago, winning in Iowa and getting second place in New Hampshire and going neck and neck with Bernie Sanders in terms of the delegate count. We saw Klobuchar hanging tough, which was another surprise, and we saw a number of other candidates drop out and disappointing nights for, as I mentioned, both Elizabeth Warren and also Vice President Joe Biden.
Let's give a listen to Senator Bernie Sanders talking in his victory speech last night, calling for unity no matter who ends up winning this thing.
No matter who wins, and we certainly hope it's going to be us, we are going to unite together. We are going to unite together and defeat the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country.
This is a point of concern, Scott, among some in the Democratic Party that Bernie Sanders supporters might nod to unite around a not Bernie Sanders candidate and vice versa. What are people talking about?
Well, these are the endangered, vulnerable Democrats, many of whom won, flipped Republican-held House seats last cycle in 2018 that helped hand the Democrats the majority of the House of Representatives. They are sounding the alarm about a possible Bernie Sanders nomination. People like Dean Phillips of Minnesota and Scott Peters of San Diego, who are saying if we nominate Bernie Sanders, there will be consequences up and down the Democratic ticket. We could not only hand the White House back to Donald Trump for another 4 years, it could even cost us the House majority, putting all power back in the hands of the Republican Party. So a lot of heartburn, a lot of consternation among some of these moderate members who are backing people like Amy Klobuchar or Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden.
Let's give a listen now to Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, finishing in a strong third place, kind of surging at the right time, people have said. Here's some of her talking last night as results came in.
Donald Trump's worst nightmare is that the people in the middle, the people who have had enough of the name calling and the mud slinging, have someone to vote for in November.
And that question of the middle there and that lane of the Democratic Party, you mentioned Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, both senators on the more progressive lane. Now we've got Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar competing for that, I don't know if you call it centrist, but more traditional Democratic Party liberal lane, and Joe Biden slipping away. And that's what a lot of people are watching for, right? Who is going to emerge in that lane as the main candidate?
That's exactly right. And it remains crowded still, despite these two contests in Iowa and New Hampshire. And that's why you have not seen any of those big names drop out yet, because Biden has made the calculation that he will do well in South Carolina and on Super Tuesday as the contest shifts more towards the South and the West, with African-American voters, which he plays very well with, and Hispanic voters. And so there's a real question as to what happens now. Does Biden continue to lose momentum, even with some of these voters who he considers his base, because of his disappointing finish in Iowa and New Hampshire? I mean, fifth place is really bad. It was so bad that he didn't even stick around for the results and got the heck out of there and flew to South Carolina, and where he held a rally with and met with some of his supporters in South Carolina. Obviously, the other big elephant in the room is Michael Bloomberg, who has vowed to spend as much as $1 billion of his own money to defeat Donald Trump. He is up on the airwaves everywhere you can imagine. And he really is the wild card in this race. And there's a lot of chatter and a lot of buzz about him.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at the big news in national politics right now, focusing in on the Democratic primary campaign so far. Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Julie is with us in Ashland. Julie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Julie?
I just wanted to talk about why my support is still very strong for Bernie Sanders.
Why is that?
Well, he's been the most consistent in his analysis. He's never varied. He's authentic. But the main reason that I support him is because I have spent a couple of trips in Sweden, which is a democratic socialist country. And I think that's the model that he's working from. And I think the fact that President Trump's new budget, which just came out, decreases Medicaid, Medicare, and tries to get rid of Obamacare, and then increases the aid to the military and for more nuclear weapons, shows how wrong his priorities are.
Julie, thanks a lot for the call. And Senator Bernie Sanders, Scott, has a pretty loyal base of supporters coming into this, even from the campaign 4 years ago. Is that that's looks like it's helping him so far, doesn't it?
Well, certainly in a state like New Hampshire, I mean, he represents Vermont, so people in neighboring New Hampshire were very familiar with him. They've known him for decades, ever since he was the mayor of Burlington. And of course, it also, you know, what his people will say. I spoke to AOC, the congresswoman from New York, yesterday. She is a big Bernie supporter. She campaigned with him on that last day before the primary, and she said that, you know, what it's going to take to sort of counter these centrist moderate Democrats who are worried about a Bernie Sanders nomination. She said what it's going to take to defeat Donald Trump will be a revolution. And the revolution, this liberal revolution, is behind Bernie Sanders at this moment in time. And so that's her sort of counterpoint to some of the concerns from the more centrist members of her own party.
We've got a few people who have left the crowded field, Deval Patrick, Andrew Yang, and Michael Bennett. None of them really seem to register in the first couple of states. What did we see from them?
Yeah, I mean, I think out of all of those, Andrew Yang had the most fervent following. Obviously, one of the first Asian American major presidential candidates who really, you know, really appealed to people, to the outsiders. He was not a politician. He didn't come up through the ranks. He was a businessman who, you know, who appealed to even some Trump supporters. Now, the question I think that a lot of us are asking in Washington is, can he bring some of those Trump supporters that were backing him over back to the Democratic Party? You know, how hard will he campaign for the nominee? He says he wants to defeat Donald Trump. And so it'll be interesting to see where the Yang gang ends up in the general election.
Let's take another call on the Democratic race. Stacy is with us in Janesville. Stacy, hello.
Hi.
Hi, where are you leaning in the race so far, if at all?
I'm leaning towards Bernie Sanders. I have a child with cerebral palsy, and I'm worried that, you know, as much as I supported the Affordable Care Act when it came out, there's been a lot of Republican attacks trying to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. I think really what we need is legislation to show that health care is a human right, which is something that Bernie has been talking about consistently. And I think that, you know, I just want to make sure that people like my son who have cerebral palsy, work, you know, he didn't choose his disability, but even people who, you know, became disabled as an adult will always have access to health care.
Stacey, thanks for the call. She's saying Bernie Sanders for the reason of health care. Scott, do you see candidates focusing a lot on health care in the primary and expect to see that in the general election as well?
Yeah, especially for the Democratic Party. I mean, they have made health care their number one issue, both in terms of House candidates that ran and flipped Republican seats in the 2018 election, as well as what we're going to be seeing going forward in the 2020 election. Now, you know, obviously Donald Trump is going to be on the ballot, and that will be hard for candidates, especially Democratic candidates, to ignore, especially following this weeks or months long impeachment trial that we've just wrapped up here. But, you know, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats will be talking about health care going forward. They think that's a winning issue for them. And it proved to be so in 2018 when they were able to take back the House.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at the presidential primaries and coming up some other stories in national politics, including big news out of the Department of Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the Democratic primary. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Scott Wong is with us from The Hill for our weekly look at the big news in national politics. We've got another caller now on the Democratic primary. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I was just thinking that Bernie Sanders has a kind of cult-like following. Some of the people that follow him won't vote for anyone but him. And I think that's really dangerous. And also, I think his ideas are what matter. And Elizabeth Warren has very similar ideas, if not exactly similar, and she has great plans. And she's also much more welcoming. She's not, you know, yelling at the audience. She's has a warmth that really appeals to me. And I'm really concerned that it's kind of a dichotomy of alienating a whole bunch of people to have Bernie Sanders as the presidential candidate.
Scott, Yordis, thanks for the call. Scott, that is a concern among not just Yordis, but some other Democrats.
Yeah, it's a concern. Well, it's going to be a concern for Democrats no matter who the nominee is, given today's Democratic Party. If it's Bernie Sanders, there will be centrists that probably will be turned off and who think Bernie is too liberal for their tastes. If it's somebody like a Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden, even though that appears unlikely at this moment, there's a real question as to whether the Bernie people will turn out in the election, or will they simply be too disenchanted with the status quo and stay at home. That's something that we saw during the 2016 election when Hillary Clinton was selected as a nominee. A lot of the Bernie people were not motivated enough to get behind Clinton, and obviously that mattered in states like Michigan and Wisconsin, where that vote was extremely close and where it went for Donald Trump.
Thanks for that call. We'll take one more caller before we move on to the rest of the stuff going on in the country. Maureen is with us in Mineral Point. Maureen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Maureen?
I was a Bernie delegate in 2016 and contributed a significant amount of money to his campaign. But this time around, I'm behind Klobuchar and Buttigieg. I'm kind of flipping between the two of them.
What led you to make that switch from Sanders to one of those two candidates?
Well, I still believe that Sanders could have won in 2016 in the general. But this time around, I think the mood of the country has changed quite a bit. And I just don't believe that the majority of people are ready for Medicare for All and free college. And I think a lot of voters will stay home if that's the option. I'll vote for Bernie, certainly, if he's the nominee. But I think the mood of the country has changed enough that that most people are looking for a little something more moderate. And I like the way that both Klobuchar and Buttigieg really try to build bridges to people of all flavors.
Maureen, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, before we move on from the issue, Maureen, in a soul-searching moment, it sounds like, trying to figure out what's going to work best for Democrats and a lot of people in a similar position all over the country as we go up to South Carolina, Nevada, and the rest coming up.
Well, and I think this idea of electability is weighing on a lot of people's minds. A lot of Democrats know that they want to see Donald Trump removed from the White House. You know, they don't necessarily love the moderate candidates, but a lot of them are shifting to this idea that if you have a moderate running against Donald Trump, there's a better chance to beat him in the November election. However, he does have His highest approval ratings yet of his presidency in this past week following acquittal in the Senate. The economy is strong, and so he does have the wind at his back, and he has the power of incumbency.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill about the big news in national politics. Scott, yeah, you had written about a big week for President Trump, but that takes us up to the news now over the last couple of days about former Trump campaign operative Roger Stone, convicted of lying to Congress, obstruction of justice, and witness tampering. Federal prosecutors recommended a prison sentence of 7 to 9 years. Now the Justice Department intervened to seek a much shorter sentence. Can you walk us through what's happened so far?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like just when President Trump had wrapped up his impeachment process and put that aside and gotten past that, he walked in right into another controversy. And so, you know, after these, after the DOJ and specifically Bill Barr moved to reduce Roger Stone's case recommend against what the four prosecutors had recommended, which was 7 to 9 years in prison. That came after tweets from President Trump, who had been complaining that the Roger Stone sentencing guidelines were of 7 to 9 years were too stringent, too tough. And so the concern now is from both Democrats and Republicans alike on Capitol Hill that the appearance, at least, is that it looks like the president is interfering in the sentencing of one of his key allies, Roger Stone, who was an informal advisor on his presidential campaign and whom he has known for decades, really. And so what you heard today was this chorus of criticism, mostly from Republican lawmakers, including Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, even Lindsey Graham, Trump's steadfast ally, who called the interference not appropriate. Typically, there is sort of this division between the president and the Justice Department, although it is his administration's Justice Department. But he's not supposed to interfere in specific cases and make recommendations about specific sentencing, especially when it pertains to one of his closest allies.
And we learned this afternoon, and I think we saw it on your Twitter feed, Scott, that Attorney General Barr has agreed to testify for the House Judiciary Committee on March 31st. That's been it's a ways away, and it's been a long time coming for Democrats on that committee. What would you anticipate happening at a hearing like that?
Well, the Democrats, led by Jerry Nadler of New York, certainly will want to question Bill Barr about the backstory of how this decision to reduce the sentencing for Roger Stone was arrived at. Did the president make a phone call? The president says he did not make a phone call, but what type of pressure did the president exert on the Justice Department and Attorney General Barr? You know, it's interesting. This was all coming from the Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler that Bill Barr is going to appear. As you mentioned, we are still many, many weeks away. I wonder if we actually will see Bill Barr on Capitol Hill for this hearing. He has not been particularly cooperative with House Democrats in the past, and I have a hard time believing that he's willing to all of a sudden change his tune and cooperate with them now.
And is there any talk of oversight on the Senate side of things with this latest news about Attorney General Barr and the Roger Stone case?
No, just a lot of huffing and puffing. But, you know, in terms of actual teeth, the Judiciary Chairman, who happens to be Lindsey Graham, as I mentioned earlier, has said he does not need to hear from Bill Barr, although he has been critical of these recent developments of the last 24 hours. So if the oversight is going to happen, it's going to happen from House Democrats who control those committees in the House of Representatives. But as I mentioned before, you know, the Trump administration has not been particularly cooperative with the House Democrats in the past.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Scott Wong, senior reporter for The Hill. He joined us for our look at the week in Washington. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll hear more about that story we were just talking about. The Department of Justice intervened in sentencing recommendations for Roger Stone, a close associate of President Trump. It's a move that many legal observers are calling unprecedented. We'll get reaction from an expert on the Department of Justice and on federal prosecutions. Also, we continue our series of interviews with candidates in Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District special election, and Milwaukee rocks, and our guests have the evidence to prove it. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Keeley Baltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, what does the updated version of NAFTA mean for the American economy? A longtime observer of trade agreements joins the show, and you could bring in your thoughts and questions. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we'll get to know some of Wisconsin's greatest naturalists, subjects of a new book by a current DNR biologist. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.